Hello, my name is Caleb Verhoeven, and we will be reading the first part of the Pantograph for Thursday, February the 19th of 2026, and we're going to go ahead and start out with U.S. politics. Democracy being tested. Dick Durbin, Ray LaHood diagnosed, suggests healing for ailing U.S. body politic. By J.D. Jack Alkire, 3 hours ago. U.S. politics. Normal. Two long-serving political stalwarts made the push for bipartisanship and a return to fact-based news coverage of governmental affairs Tuesday night, in the first of 5 democracy dialogues events in Bloomington Normal. Retiring Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Springfield, and Peoria native Ray LaHood, former Republican congressman and transportation secretary for President Barack Obama, spoke to a crowd of roughly 400 in Braden Auditorium at Illinois State University in Normal. They answered questions on a wide range of topics, including social media, the state of journalism, gerrymandering, hyperpolarization of political lines, and the health of the democratic experiment in America. I am an optimist, or I never would have gotten into politics, Durbin said, who announced last year that he will not be seeking re-election after nearly 30 years in the Senate. I think we're going through what now is a test. We're being tested in ways about the Constitution that we've never been tested before. I always thought the greatest test, of course, was the Civil War. We fought and killed one another over the issue of slavery and states' rights, Durbin continued. But when it came down to this particular situation, we're dealing with the challenges we have never seen before when it comes to our Constitution. I think we'll last in the challenge, but it will take a while. Key moments. LaHood, who represented Illinois' 18th congressional district from 1995 to 2009, said the Constitution has been the main guiding principle of the United States since 1788 and as the nation celebrates its 250th anniversary. We are the beacon of hope and the beacon of light for the world, he said. People around the world want to replicate what we have done in our country, in the way that we've done it as we follow the Constitution. Nothing will ever be a better backstop for whatever happens. To that end, LaHood said, despite the conception of hard lines, keeping elected officials in both Democratic and Republican parties from reaching across the aisle, bipartisanship still exists. The majority of people who serve in the Congress serve to benefit the people who sent them there and to benefit the country, he said. There is a lot more bipartisan activity that takes place. There's a lot more bipartisan work that takes place that never gets the headlines. Recently, President Donald Trump's Department of Justice sought to indict 2 sitting U.S. senators, Mark Kelly, a Democrat from Arizona, and Alyssa Stockland, a Democrat from Michigan, on charges of seditious conspiracy related to senators calling for military members to reject unlawful orders. A District of Columbia grand jury did not approve the charges. What they're going after, Kelly and Slocklin, for was an expression of free speech, which I think is pretty obvious, Durbin said. But that is an indication of the lengths of the administration will go to quiet its critics. I think it's an extreme example of lack of respect for the respective branches of government. I hope we never see this happen again. Both Durbin and LaHood said the shift of news consumption from legacy media, like newspapers and radio news, to social media has added an unreliable media atmosphere. Social media has allowed for politicians and candidates to say whatever they want, right or wrong, true or false, about anybody and not to be accountable for it, LaHood said, something that Durbin had echoed. The source of information or the future is critical. If we don't have a healthy press, then we have nothing, like many of us remember, Durbin said to robust applause. Where in the world can a conscientious person go to learn the facts and draw their good conclusions from them? That to me is troubling more than almost anything. Among the myriad issues that both men agreed on, there was one that seemed slightly contentious in the present day, gerrymandering. Solving the issue is difficult because constitutionally, drawing legislative and congressional districts is delegated to the states and not to the federal government. While Durbin noted there is a problem in the practice that allows whichever party is in its power to draw political districts favoring their candidates, he also acknowledged a gerrymander is what got him his first election in the 1980s to the U.S. House of Representatives. You have to deal with it on a national basis, he said. You can't just say blue states are going to get rid of gerrymandering and the red states are not. If you're going to do this and try to have some justice and fairness in it, everybody has to be a part of it. LaHood agreed. Gerrymandering has poisoned the well, and it's very difficult, as Senator Durbin said, unless we deal with it on a national level. Democracy Dialogues. There are four more Democracy Dialogues events scheduled this year as part of the McLean County Museum of History's celebration of America's 250th anniversary. They will feature breakout sessions and follow topics surrounding key phrases from the Declaration of Independence. From 1 to 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, February the 28th, will be the Life and Liberty. From 1 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, April the 11th, will be the Pursuit of Happiness. From 6:30 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, September the 22nd, All Men Are Created Equal. And from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, November the 19th, Consent of the Governed. Registration is required at mchistory.org/events. In other news, trust in health agencies is eroding. Americans are unsure what to believe in RFK Jr. era, by Mike Staub and Ali Swenson, 3 hours ago, Associated Press. Analysis, New York. Since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was sworn in to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services 1 year ago, he has defended his upending of federal health policy by saying the changes will restore trust in America's public health agencies. But as the longtime leader of the anti-vaccine movement scales back immunization guidance and dismisses scientists and advisors, he has clashed with top medical groups who say he is not following the science. The confrontation is deepening confusion that surged during COVID-19 pandemic. Surveys show that trust in the agencies Kennedy leads is falling, not rising, as the country's health landscape undergoes dramatic change. Kennedy says he aims to boost transparency to empower Americans to make their own health choices. Doctors counter that he is spreading false and unverified information that is causing major, perhaps irreversible, damage. People once trusted health agencies, regardless of party, and the government reported, quote-unquote, the best of what science knows at this point, said Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, you cannot confidently go to federal websites and know that, she said. HHS spokesman Andrew Nixon said that the trust had suffered during the Biden administration. Kennedy's mandate is to restore transparency, scientific rigor, and accountability, he said. New findings from the healthcare research nonprofit KFF show that 47% of Americans trust the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, quote-unquote, a great deal or a fair amount, to provide reliable vaccine information, down about 10% points since the beginning of Trump's second term. Trust among Democrats dropped 9 percentage points since September to 55%, the survey found. Trust among Republicans and independents hasn't changed since September, but it has declined somewhat among both groups since the beginning of Trump's term. Even among supporters of Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again movement, fewer than half say they trust agencies like the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration a lot, or some, to make recommendations about childhood vaccine schedules. Gallup surveys also show a drop in Americans who believe the CDC is doing a good job, from 40% in 2024 to only 31% last year. Historically, federal scientific and public health agencies enjoyed strong ratings and opinion polls. The CDC, for decades, scored above many other government agencies in Gallup surveys, asking whether they're doing a good or an excellent job. 2 decades ago, more than 60% of Americans gave the CDC high marks, according to Gallup, but that number plummeted at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, amid agency mistakes and guidance that some people didn't like. In 2020, the percentage of Americans who believe the CDC was doing at least a good job fell 40% and then leveled off for a few years. Part of Kennedy's pitch as health secretary has been restoring Americans' trust in public health. We're going to tell them what we know. We're going to tell them what we don't know. And we're going to tell them we're researching and how we're doing it, Kennedy told senators about the CDC last September. It's the only way to restore trust in the agency. Kennedy has wielded the power of his office to take steps that diverge from medical consensus. Last May, he announced COVID-19 vaccines were no longer recommended for healthy children and pregnant women, a move that doctors called very concerning as well as confusing. In November, he directed the CDC to abandon its position that vaccines do not cause autism without supplying new evidence. Earlier this year, the CDC reduced the number of vaccines recommended for every child, a decision medical groups said would undermine protections against a half dozen diseases. Kennedy also overhauled his department through canceled grants and mass layoffs. Last summer, he fired his CDC chief over vaccine policy disagreements. Some have applauded the moves, but surveys suggest that many Americans do not. Shocked by Kennedy's dismantling of public health norms, professional medical groups have urged Americans not to follow the new vaccine recommendations. They say they were adopted without public input or compelling evidence. More than 200 public health and advocacy groups have urged Congress to investigate Kennedy's change to the vaccine schedule, while many Democratic-led states have created their own alliances to counter Kennedy's vaccine guidance. We see burgeoning confusion about which sources to trust and which sources are real. That makes our decision-making on an individual level much harder, said Dr. Megan Rainey, dean of the Yale School of Public Health. She said she worried the confusion was contributing to the rise in diseases like whooping cough and measles, once largely eliminated in the United States. Surveys indicate growing public wavering over support for the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. On August Annenberg, survey found that 82% would be very or somewhat likely to recommend that an eligible child in their household get the MMR vaccine, compared with 90% in November of 2024. AP writer Amelia Thompson DeVoe in Washington contributed to this report. In other news, beginning from ashes, Ash Wednesday marks season of spiritual renewal before Easter, 3 hours ago. Instructor Amy O'Donoghue left and Father Andrew O'Brien placed ash across the foreheads of students and worshipers during Ash Wednesday services at the St. Mary's Catholic Church in Bloomington on Wednesday, February the 18th of 2026. This service marks the beginning of the Christian Lenten season of prayer, fasting, and repentance leading up to Easter by Clay Jackson from the Pantograph. Robertson murder trial starts. Rage or self-defense at the heart of shooting case in Ellsworth by Caitlin Klepek 3 hours ago. Bloomington. Desiree Robertson had planned to kill her husband out of rage and revenge, the prosecution said at the end of the start of her murder trial. But the defense presented an alternative motive, self-defense. Robertson, 42, is charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder in the shooting death of 41-year-old Daniel J. Shelby, who died Wednesday, January the 10th of 2024, in their Ellsworth home. After a 12-person jury was sworn in Tuesday afternoon, Assistant State's Attorney David Rossi and Assistant Public Defender Mackenzie Frizzle began with opening statements before Judge John Knapp at the McLean County Law and Justice Center in Bloomington. Both attorneys agreed Robertson had discovered Shelby was having an affair, but still at issue is whether she intended to kill her husband that January morning. Rossi called it a premeditated act, while Frizzle said, "This is a case about survival." The prosecution's opening. Rossi began his statement shortly after the jury was sworn in, saying that the defendant had called 911 that January morning and told the dispatcher she shot her husband in the face following an argument that turned violent. The prosecutor noted Shelby was shot twice in the head and said the evidence will prove that this was not an act of self-defense. It was an act of rage and revenge, he said. Instead of separating after discovering her husband's affair, Robertson resorted to violence, Rossi said, referencing text messages that were sent both to the victim and to the woman with whom he had been having a relationship. The text sent before Shelby was shot were threatening in nature, Rossi said. You're going to see who's going to be laughing last, Rossi said, quoting a message Robertson sent to Shelby. I'll kill you and that woman. Upon being confronted, the defendant immediately became violent, Rossi said. Folks, this was not self-defense. The evidence shows this was deliberate, calculated decision by the defendant to end Daniel Shelby's life, Rossi said. But opposing counsel told a different story. The defense's turn. Desiree is innocent, Frizzle said. This is not a case about murder. This is a case about survival. Frizzle said the couple had met when Robertson was 15 years old, and that they had been together for about 24 years. Over the course of that relationship, Shelby had become physically abusive, Frizzle said. Although Robertson had tried not to report the violence, Frizzle said the abuse reached a point to where it quote-unquote went too far to let it go undetected by law enforcement. The defense attorney noted a May 2022 domestic violence case in which the defendant was listed as the victim and Shelby as the perpetrator. As the trial proceeds over the next few days, Frizzle said she will present recorded phone call evidence that will show that Shelby, manipulating and threatening Robertson to make the reference case, quote-unquote, go away. Online court records indicate the domestic violence case was dismissed. Additionally, Frizzle said, when Robertson discovered her husband's affair, she read a text that he had sent to the other woman, I will kill Robertson if she gets in the way. And on January the 10th of 2024, Robertson confronted Shelby, who subsequently strangled her, Frizzle said. The defense attorney noted Robertson's injuries are consistent with both having been strangled and Shelby was the initial aggressor. His last words were, you gonna kill me? I'm gonna kill you. He was faced with a gun and still come at her. The evidence will show he still tried to pursue her, said Frizzle. The first witness. After opening statements ended, the 911 call was played. The court could hear Robertson crying over the phone as she reported to police that she had shot her husband. In the courtroom, Robertson began dabbing tears with a tissue as the audio played. Deputy Kenneth Richmond of the McLean County Sheriff's Office was the first person to respond to the scene. He took the stand Tuesday as the state's first witness. Footage from the deputy's body camera showed Robertson waiting for police outside of her home, dressed in pajamas and a puffy coat. She was seen crying in the video, which was noted by the deputy. Richmond said he placed Robertson in custody at about 8:11 a.m. and searched the area. After a security sweep was done of the residence, the deputy testified he drove Robertson to Carl Roman Medical Center in Normal at 1:53 p.m. for treatment of injuries from the altercation with Shelby. Following the deputy's testimony, the trial broke for the day at 4:08 p.m. Crime and Courts Spotlight. Bloomington Man Detained on Sex Abuse Charges Involving a Teenage Girl by Caitlin Klepek, 19 hours ago. Bloomington. A McLean County judge ordered a Bloomington man facing 14 felonies involving a sexual relationship with a minor be detained pending trial. Khalil C. Grismore, who also goes by Khalil Davis, 24, appeared Tuesday afternoon before Judge Amy McFarland for a detention hearing. He is charged with two counts of dissemination of child sex abuse material, Class X felonies, five counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse, which are Class 2 felonies, two counts of possession of child sexual abuse material, which is Class 3 felonies, four counts of possession of child sexual abuse material involving videos, Class 2 felonies, and grooming, a Class 4 felony. The prosecution, represented by Assistant State's Attorney Daniel Guido, agreed the defendant posed a danger to the community, which could not be mitigated by other measures. Guido read the probable cause statement, which described the charges. On March 11th of 2025, an underage girl and her mother reported to the Bloomington Police Department that Grismore had a sexual relationship with the girl in the summer of 2024. The girl's mother reported that her daughter disclosed the relationship to her 2 days prior. Guido said Grismore had filmed his sexual abuse of the minor girl, paid the girl for sex, and exchanged nude images with the girl. The girl told police that Grismore had bought her lingerie with his name on them, which she provided to police as evidence, as well as other sexual objects. In March of 2025, an Instagram account, which the police later confirmed to be operated by Grismore, began sending out videos of the defendant and the minor girl having sex. The girl and the strangers and people she knew had received the videos, according to the probable cause statement. In arguing for his release, Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace said the relationship between Grismore and the underage girl was consensual. Both parties were said to have taken videos and photographs of themselves and of each other. Wallace also said, quote-unquote, nothing else suggests he's approached other minors. Guido argued the girl could not consent to a sexual relationship because she was a minor. McFarland granted the state's petition to deny pretrial release and order Grismore to be detained. His next court hearing is scheduled for April the 1st. In other crime and court news, armed robberies were reported on North Main Street in Bloomington 18 hours ago. Bloomington officers are investigating an armed robbery reported late Monday night at a business on North Main Street. Officers were dispatched at 9:57 p.m. on February the 16th to the 900 block of North Main Street after receiving a report of robbery, according to a news release. Authorities said a suspect had entered the business, brandished a handgun, and demanded money from the cashier. The suspect fled on foot with an undisclosed amount of cash and was last seen traveling southbound on Center Street. The suspect is described as a black man, approximately 20 to 30 years old, about 5 feet 8 inches tall, with a slight to medium build. Police did not provide any more specific information about his description. No injuries were reported in connection with this incident. The Bloomington Police Department asked residents and business owners in the area to review surveillance footage from around the time of the robbery for any suspicious activity that could be related. Anyone with information is asked to contact Detective John Gaffney at 309-434-2672 or jgaffney at cityblm.org. Once again, anyone with information about this robbery is asked to contact Detective John Gaffney at 309-434-2672 or jgaffney at cityblm.org. Anonymous tips can be submitted to the Department's Crime and Intelligence Analysis Unit at 309-434-2963 or CIAU at cityblm.org. Tips can also be texted to 847-411 by sending BPD tips followed by the information. In other news that might affect everyone, soaring coffee prices shift routines by Matt Sedinsky, the Associated Press, 3 hours ago. New York. For years, it was a daily McDonald's trip for a cup of coffee with 10 sugars and 5 creams. Later, it was Starbucks caramel macchiatos with almond milk and 2 pumps of syrup. Coffee has been a morning ritual for Sandra Donaldson since she was old enough to drink it. But, dismayed by the rising prices, the 35-year-old from Washington, D.C. did the unthinkable. She gave it up. "I did that daily for years. I loved it. It was just my routine," she says, "and now it's not." Years of climbing coffee prices prompted some in this country of coffee lovers to unpin their habits by nixing cafe visits, switching to cheaper brews, or just foregoing it completely. Coffee prices in the United States were up 18.3% in January from a year ago, according to the latest Consumer Price Index that was released Friday. Over 5 years ago, the government reported coffee prices rose 47%. Before I thought, there's no way I could make it through my day without coffee, says Liz Sweeney, 50, of Boise, Idaho, a former quote-unquote coffee addict who cut her consumption. Now, my car is not on automatic pilot. Sweeney used to have 3 cups of coffee at home each day and stop at a cafe whenever she left the house. As prices climbed last year, she nixed coffee shop visits and cut her intake to 1 cup a day at home. To make up for the caffeine, she pops open a can of Diet Coke at home or rolls through McDonald's for one. Dan DeBond, 34, of Minnetonka, Minnesota, likewise trimmed back on the coffee shop visits, conscious of the increasing expense as he and his wife save up for a house. What used to be a $2 coffee is now $5 or $6, said DeBond, who now buys ground coffee at Trader Joe's and fills up a Travelo mug to bring to the office. How time flies. 3 hours ago, 100 years ago, on February the 19th of 1926, old Boreos come riding into Bloomington last night on the back of a blizzard that whipped the great Northwest country to a whisper. At 7 o'clock last night, 2.5 inches of snow had fallen. Drifting snow prevented an accurate reading after that time, but it is thought that as much snow as it fell in between that time and the time when the snow ceased. 75 years ago, on February the 19th of 1951, all street lights at Bloomington intersections will be turned on this week, Mayor Cecile Cohn announced. About half of the street lights were turned off December the 1st in an economy move by the mayor. The lights that are off in the middle of blocks and in alleys will stay off for the time being. 50 years ago, on February the 19th of 1976, nickel beers may be the biggest thing since sliced bread, but Treasurer Alan Dixon's offer didn't pack him in at the Red Lion in Bloomington on February the 18th. Dixon, Democratic candidate for Secretary of State, in his campaign chest, footed the cost for only a few takers. 25 years ago, on February the 19th of 2001, 14-year-old Bloomington Junior High student Brian Guther collected 1,739 pairs of eyeglasses for the needy, as the project needed to fulfill requirements for the rank of an Eagle Scout. That also earned him the thanks of the Danvers Lion Club, which honored him for his philanthropic effort at a recent meeting. The eyeglasses will be taken to the Lions annual convention this week, where they will be turned over for future distribution. Today's Flick Fact. 3 hours ago. Question. Lake Bloomington is 10.4 feet down as the water crisis in Bloomington builds and water is being drawn out of its backup Evergreen Lake. And now there are added worries that as the weather warms, the city's water supply may be further taxed because so many cars are headed to the car wash. Do you know how much water car washes in Bloomington use in 1 month? Answer. In January, city records show Bloomington car washes used 10,829 cubic feet of water, or 81,005 gallons. You gotta love the warmer weather, says Mayor Dan Brady. Now we're hoping it might also bring some rain. In past years, on spring-like days during winter, one popular car wash, Rainstorm Express, reported about 500 cars getting washed a day, its otherwise daily average of 200 to 250. My name is Kayla Verhoeven, and you are listening to the first part of the Pantograph, and I will join you again soon for the second part of the Pantograph. Until then, friends, I hope you have a great day, enjoy this warm weather, and stay safe.